Today I'm excited to be chatting with Daisy. Daisy is a communication designer, printmaker and calligrapher based in London with an interest in social design and design for good. So, Daisy, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you. It's very nice to be here.
How's your day been so far?
It's been good. So I work for a little design studio in Shrewsbury. So we've just had four interns start, actually. So I'm helping with kind of micromanaging and things like that. But we do a lot of public sector work. So we apply for a lot of tenders and things like that. And so we're trying to fine tune our process in applying for those at the moment. So it's how we search for them, like how we're able to personalize each proposal and our cred decks and things like that. And figuring out the best people to delegate certain bits to and things like that. It's the slightly less glamorous side of design that people don't get to see, which is probably for the best, because otherwise most people probably wouldn't get involved.
It's the secret stuff.
Yeah, exactly. It's the stuff that actually brings in the money.
I was going to ask first, what was your route like into the creative industry? So sort of like, when did you realise that you wanted to go down a creative path?
I suppose it's always been deep rooted within me, but I actually started studying fine art. So I guess I came to everything from a slightly different viewpoint. So I did my degree at Falmouth in fine art, and actually I finished. I was making really self-indulgent artwork about trying to understand my own psyche and all of the really pretentious stuff that makes people really hate fine artists. I actually ended up doing a bunch of work kind of based around social engagement. So I hosted embroidery sessions for women to come and talk about gynecology and process their, find some form of catharsis and process any trauma that they had associated with their body and their relationship with their body. And I think it was through that I realized that I really enjoyed not doing the really self-indulgent stuff and actually making stuff that had a purpose. So after I finished my degree, and I think this is the same for any creative degree, I left not really knowing what the hell I was going to do, how to promote myself as an artist, how to even price my work or anything like this. So, and how to think conceptually and things like this, which I love the fact that I've learned the ability to do so.
Yeah.
But it would also have been really great to have learned real life skills as well. So I spent a year working as a printmaker, and from that I realised that having a fine art degree meant that I wasn't particularly employable. So I applied to do a degree, well, a master's in communication design, and so I did that again at Falmouth, and I graduated, well, I technically haven't quite graduated, but thank you, COVID. So I went in with from a really unromantic point of view and a very strategic kind of like, this is how I am gonna find my way of making a mark in the world / actually earn a salary, which would be really nice because being self-employed is one of the most terrifying existences ever. But as I was doing the masters, I realized that I enjoyed making work that had a purpose, whether that was for clients or whether it was finding a way of actually communicating a message, and that's the beautiful difference between design and fine art, is the fact that you're actually communicating something rather than it just being there for interpretation.
Definitely, so true. And I mean, definitely about the sort of money aspect of what they teach you at university.
Yeah, I mean, you're definitely, I don't think they teach that on any course when it comes to the creative sectors.
No, not at all.
Which is terrifying. Like, I still don't know how to price myself. Although I'm working for Design by Country, I'm also working as a freelance designer, and so it's that kind of like, I still have no idea how to price my work or anything like this. I know full well that I'm totally undermining myself, because I go, but no one's going to want to pay me that much, so I may as well charge them this amount and do shitloads of work. Sorry.
No, it's fine.
Really good at swearing. and end up being paid like £4 an hour because of the amount of hours that I've ended up being like putting into a piece of work.
Yeah.
So it'd be really nice if that side of education changed slightly, rather than it being so theoretical, actually being real life practical would be great.
Would be really, really helpful.
So I think, so I've always been creative and always existed in that creative sphere, but I suppose I've teetered on the edge of everything, really. I'm one of those people that I really love the idea of being able to do everything, like craft-wise. So whether it's like knitting and embroidery to bookbinding and those kinds of things, it's just that kind of like being able to have as many like tools and skills in my little box that I can just kind of grab at any point. You never know when they're going to be helpful.
No, that's very true. I think when people are like, oh, jack of all trades is a really bad thing. Or like, you have to have like a particular niche in something. And it's like, oh no, I wanna like everything.
We had this conversation a lot during my master's. And I did my final essay that I did for my master's was actually looking at the kind of changing place and position of the designer in the world and how it's changed over the last kind of few decades. And the fact that it's becoming more and more encouraged to actually be a jack of all trades rather than having one. Like, obviously, it's incredibly amazing if you can be that specific and you go into being able to find that niche little market. But I also can't imagine doing that for the rest of my like career. I need that. I need to be able to chop and change and find certain things that I can really take a bite out of and really like chew on for a bit.
When you were saying how there's been this crossover with fine art and design, we mentioned when we were talking that there would be this sense of imposter syndrome.
Oh, 100%. When I was doing my master's, we were a huge mix of people, and that's the beautiful thing about doing a master's. That's why everyone should do some form of further education, maybe not directly after their degree, like have a bit of life experience and things like this, but absolutely go and do a master's. But even in that environment, so I was fine art, we had a girl that was, she was from Milan, and she did, her original degree was in psychology, and she went into communication design from that. We had someone that did music, journalism, and we had advertising and a few people that had done graphic design. And we also had Ian, who was an absolute godsend. So he didn't have a degree when he went into design. He's been working in the industry for the last like 30 years or something like this, but wants to become a lecturer and is becoming a lecturer. And that's basically the only reason that he did the master's. But being around those people, even knowing that there were some people who had less digital skills than I did, but I had so little confidence in my digital skills even a year and a half ago. that I would wait until everyone had left to actually work on one of the main computers to do anything, because I was so conscious of people judging my abilities to do anything or anything like this. Like, I've always been really bad at asking for help because I feel like I'm going to be found out as a bluffer.
Yeah. Oh, I completely agree with that. Yeah.
And I think, and we actually, and again, we had a really interesting conversation with Ian about imposter syndrome, because we were all talking about it. And the fact that even at a master's level, we're still feeling it. But Ian disagreed and felt that actually, without having worked in the industry, you can't necessarily have that feeling. But see, I disagree. I think that even if you're about to, it doesn't matter whether it's a professional situation, whether it's, or even a social situation, I think that there's always going to be at least one person that just goes, why am I here? No, I mean, my boss will probably hate me for saying it, but every morning I wake up and go, how have I ended up? How have I ended up here? I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I must be doing a good job because I'm still here and I'm still still being employed. But part of me goes, I'm going to be found out, and they're going to show me the door and be like, cheers for your help, love. But I mean, enough's enough.
I think, yeah, no, definitely. I think it's one of those things that I think about and I'm like, oh, but I've been doing a degree for 3 years. I should know everything about graphic design. I should know every single bit of software, every single bit of like...
Yeah.
And then, but realistically, like, we're not going to know everything, are we?
No, exactly. And I honestly think that actually it's when you start looking at job applications and like vacancy adverts that put the fear of God in you, because you have to have had, like, for an entry level job, you have to have had 5 years worth of experience and know all of these bits of software. But, you know, it'll be an added bonus if you like dogs. And it's that kind of like, how is anyone coming out of university or any form of like, or wanting to go into the industry, meant to do anything but make bloody cups of tea? And it's terrifying. And I think it feeds into all of this. And I mean, and I have a very questionable opinion of awards like DNAD and primarily New Blood, not necessarily for the studios.
Yeah.
Also, the grading system that happens within a lot of creative subjects is it feeds into this insecurity. It's so subjective. So how are you meant to actually grade anything like that? How you're the encouragement of comparison to your peers can be so damaging to some people. And I don't know whether that's necessarily... is ever really considered. And I think that's one thing that could actually be amazing with the fact that so many kids haven't been able to do their GCSEs and their A-levels and things like that. It might actually make a positive change to the way that education is put forward. And I mean, I'm hoping anyway.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah, because I think it's more about their ability to show up and interact rather than an actual ability. Yeah.
Remember a bunch of... Yeah, they should be learning all of that stuff, but actually a test on, like, I mean, how much of a book you can remember in English Lit, like, how beneficial really is that?
Because I don't remember any of that stuff. Nothing.
No,
it's gone completely over my head.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, Pythagoras, at what point has that ever been helpful in my adult life?
I don't even know what that is anymore. Like, I couldn't tell you. Oh, but yeah, no, 100%. I think I was going to say as well, we got our So each end of term, we get like a grade and just to like plot out where we are and some feedback on projects. And yesterday, like we were going like a proper, it was difficult because you'd get like this really good feedback and you'd be like, oh, okay, like I can work on this, like cool. And then you'd get the grade and you'd be like, what? Like, hang on.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's like one of those, like my friend got like really, really good feedback. And then, but the grade wasn't at the feet.
Didn't marry
up. No. And then she, like, after she'd seen that grade, she was like, oh, well, I'm shit. And it's like, yeah. it's gonna make you feel that way, isn't it? Because you're comparing what someone else's grade got, not on the feedback and what they've said you're really good at.
Yeah, exactly. It's a big conversation that I had with in one of the interviews for my final project with Craig Oldham, where he was just like, no, grading it's just pointless. And at that point I was kind of like, but surely you need to have that kind of like level playing field and all of this. But actually the more that I've thought about it, the more I'm just like, for why do we need to have these things?
Because I think at the end of the day it is, and when you're looking for jobs and stuff, it is just about like what you can bring to the table and your portfolio of work.
Exactly. No one actually cares if you got a 2-2 in your degree. It's how you carry yourself, how you're able to talk about your work, and the actual work that is put forward. That's what people need to learn and what they need to be told. Instead of having this like deep, intense pressure in feeling like, well, if I didn't get a first, then I'm never going to make it as a designer. Because the sad thing is actually, I think it's like less than a quarter of people that graduate from graphic design actually go into working in the agencies that we're built up to think that we're good enough to work in. I think, yeah, something ridiculous like that. But that doesn't mean that you are not a good designer. Plumbers need business cards. Everybody deserves access to good design. That is one of the things I fundamentally believe. It doesn't matter whether you're working for Grey London or whether you're working for Turner Duckworth and you're doing bits of pro bono work. The corner shop down the road, they still deserve nice branding. And think about the impact that that's going to have on all of their business. Like that, and I think that's one of the reasons why I got so kind of het up in social design and things like that, is the fact that there's such a focus on it being this, has to be this massive project that makes like global change, when actually it can even just be the tiniest thing. I think there's an amazing vibrator company called Dame, and they basically put together a campaign which so many, like, they wouldn't actually put up images of the sex toys or things like this, even though they're not actually phallic, they're not provocative or anything like this. I mean, if you look at them, the majority of them, they look like an egg.
Yeah.
Like, they don't look like, they're not alluring or anything like this. But actually, if you look at anything that advertises male pleasure, the use of phallic symbols, like a cactus in the shape of a penis, or anything to do with that, is fine, and that is totally accepted. The fact that they're out there trying to push this, and they're being told that they can't put up their billboards because the world has no like acknowledgement of female pleasure. They found a way around that, and I think that something along those lines still needs to be included in the idea of social design. Yeah. Because you're breaking through taboos and you are breaking through these things. And it's trying to, and trying to understand the definition of all of those things is one of the biggest challenges.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, well, going on from that is a bit more about A Place of Unlearning, which was your project.
We had to do a social design module on our masters, and we ended up working with a charity that, after a week of all of us doing research, we discovered that actually we found where they stood to be quite problematic, and decided that we didn't want to work with them anymore. So I went down the rabbit hole of I think it's Bruce Newman that wrote the article of Is Humanitarian Design the New Imperialism? And there are the majority of examples of poor social design come from designers who don't understand the problem, or actually identify a problem that isn't necessarily a problem because they come from a different culture, and imposing a Western design solution upon that problem. So I got really fascinated through all of this, and with this idea of good and bad design, and the and design for good and design for social change, and they kind of all mesh into one but also don't at the same time. So A Place of Unlearning, and it's also impossible to find any information on social design that isn't academic, basically. So A Place of Unlearning is, I suppose, it's a digital archive of conversations with people within the creative industry. So that's textiles, advertising, architecture, graphic design, wanting to understand where all of these people sat in the defining of design for social change. So the intention of it is, and the kind of story behind the name, is the fact that you're basically coming to unlearn and relearn about social design. And I think that that's something that's so integral with so many things nowadays. The more that comes up about the kind of colonialization and effects that that has had on education throughout the world, and not just within the UK, is a reason why it's so important for people to almost forget what they were taught in school and reapproach it from other avenues. So big conversation. So we had huge conversations about whether the fact that, and in my opinion, our government is almost excused for their lack of social responsibility that they hold. And I think that massive kind of like social traumas that have happened in this country. So obviously COVID is an incredible example of that. And the idea of herd immunity at the beginning and not even taking into consideration the effect that that would have on our NHS is just madness. But also looking at the cause and response and everything that surrounds the story of the Grenfell Tower and that absolute disaster. All of these things build up, and wondering, I mean, I definitely believe personally that it's had a huge effect on the relevance of design for social change and the need for, or the encouragement that designers have now felt the need to create these subsections of design to almost make up for the fact that the government aren't necessarily pulling their weight. But it was also identifying whether people had a difference in definition between design for good and design for social change. I mean, most people thought that design for good was just a bit wishy-washy and a bit crap, which it is. Whereas design for social change or social design actually has this impact. And you can, and I think that you can even tell that from the two terms in themselves. But it was really, but the most interesting part of all of it was the fact that not one person had the same definition as the other. They all kind of tiptoed around each other. And another part that I found quite interesting, and kind of the aesthetic and the and this idea of it being an unofficial school of thought, it means that everything comes from Greek philosophy and things like that. So that's why everybody is drawn as a marble bust, and you've got Craig Oldham as the cynic, and you have there's a woman, Emily, who works at the Butterfly Works in Amsterdam. A positive nihilist is how she described herself, which I absolutely loved. And so they all kind of fed into this. And you've got Andrew Fisher, who's now based in Australia, but when I first met him, he was still working at Saatchi & Saatchi. But he was incredibly candid of the fact that he never wants to put out harm into the world. And he's done some pretty cool stuff. Like, he did a massive, massive billboard, and it was just like one for, I think it was like a national racism campaign or something like this. And it was a picture of the earth and a picture of the moon. And it just said, "Don't like your neighbours, then move." Or something along those lines. Like, it's so 90s, but it's still, like, it's still timeless in a way. But he was incredibly honest about the fact that he's got two boys. And so actually, if it's going to pay, it's going to pay. And that's actually something that he has to really focus on. So it was, so he's actually listed as the patriarch, but not in a kind of like anti-feminist way. It's the fact that he had that beautiful kind of candid, these are the things that I need to focus on. Yeah, there were just some absolutely amazing people. And I'm really proud of the piece of work that I managed to make from it.
Yeah, you should be. I think it was just amazing that there's so many people that you've spoke to in so many different sectors of what they do, and it's so broad.
Well, I made sure that all of the questions were the same for every person. I mean, there are a couple of deviations, but it means that there is this clarity in conversation, and it's easier then to have that comparison as well, which within trying to identify a definition for something is so important.
I just think it's so great. And anyone that's listening, go have a look. Definitely. Because it's... And I think it's so important to be honest about things like this. Like, they were so... Like you said, they just so honest and said what they thought.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of my favourite questions was asking whether there was a social status or a kind of status value that comes from being able to describe yourself as a social designer. Because I think, like, I have so much respect for people that work in charity and work within the public sector for kind of social works and things like this. But there are a handful of people within that kind of world that are quite worthy. And so when you start putting a designer into that sector, you can then end up with someone that can be a little bit, like, intolerable in a way. Especially when somebody, like, hits that worthiness level. But the thing that most people said was it definitely gave you a status value, but it's as it does with any label, whether you're an art director, whether you're an intern, every single thing will, like, I quite like my title at work as a brand strategist. I find it quite sexy in a way. I'm not entirely sure why.
Brand strategist.
Brand strategist. Exactly. I don't know if there's something about having a definition for yourself that is really comforting. And I think someone has to be incredibly confident within themselves to exist outside of that sphere, which again is one of the reasons why I have quite a lot of respect for Craig Oldham, because he just doesn't really exist in that world.
No, yeah. He's just like...
He just is who he is.
Which I think is also, yeah, so great.
I mean, it takes a lot of balls.
Yeah. Because I think... Because it's even when people ask you, like, oh, well, what do you do? And it's like... I don't know what I do. I'm just here.
It was like when I finished my master's, I finished in August and I did a month's internship, just kind of being a bit of a dog's body for a local studio in Shrewsbury again. And but between the, and that was in October, I think, that I ended up doing that. And between those months, I was like, well, what do I call myself? I've kind of gone with, and I've kind of kept it going, but I've ended up going with, like, designer maker, because I feel like it crosses over, like, my practice crosses over in so many ways. Like, I still have a collaboration with an apron company going where I hand print, hand lino print aprons with them, with Risden and Risden. But then I'm also working on brand identity for an arts trail in Shrewsbury and things like this. So it's that, where do you find that definition? Should I just go for it and just not have a definition? But then how do you explain what you do at the same time?
It's so hard. And I think I'm really scared to graduate. And I can't be like, oh, hi, I'm Georgia at Nottingham Trent, third year. That's what I am.
you get so used to having that as part of your identity.
Yeah.
It's a really strange feeling to have, not being able to turn around and go, oh, yeah, I'm a design student or I'm a fine art student. Like,
yeah,
especially when you spend 3 years working in that particular field, it's so hard to then shed that identity and kind of come out of your cocoon, supposedly meant to be this fully formed butterfly, when actually you've probably got a couple of scraggly wings that haven't quite formed properly because the university just haven't helped you develop those properly. Which is probably quite a terrifying, I'm not meaning to scare you or anything like this. But there is some amazing, like Intern magazine, they have some absolutely amazing like courses and things like this that aren't particularly expensive, but it means that you are taught by professionals on how to actually turn yourself into a professional, how to price yourself, how not to undermine yourself, which I think is such a common trait in new designers, because where do you find that confidence? I mean, the people that go straight into freelance work, I mean, I don't really feel like I count as one of these because I'm an old fogey coming out of education. Like, being 27 when I graduated and kind of going into a new industry, I feel a bit like an like a bit of an old lady compared to everyone else. But we're getting there, it's fine. But that shouldn't be a hang up.
No. And in that respect, it must have felt really difficult to be like, oh, well, I am still new. Like, I'm still...
Yeah, it's a really strange feeling to have. So I expected, my first day of my master's, I expected to be kind of, like, surrounded by people that were maybe, like, 22. At, like, 24... and going upwards, so I'd be like sat in the middle.
Yeah,
I was like the second oldest, other than Ian, who's in his 50s, and then it was me. That's and then mad. Everyone else was like 23 to 21. And it just, it, like, it was so strange. And yeah. I think that fed into the imposter syndrome as well. I think that made me kind of go, oh no, like, I'm actually, am I making a massive mistake starting a new career? Or even just starting a career, actually, because I basically, all I got from studying fine art was how to work in hospitality and stand behind a bar. Like, that and make silicone molds of plastic baby heads. Like, made some weird stuff. But it is that, it's like, well, what else do you learn? It, like, I don't want to spend my life, it's not like I'm a chef or something like that. It's not like I can happily kind of go be like super passionate about food and go, you know what, in like 5 years time I'm going to be working in a 1-star or a 3-star or something like this. Yeah. Like, therefore hospitality is a beneficial experience to have. When you're going into fundamentally an office job, obviously not currently because everybody's working remotely, it's that kind of like, well, this is just utterly foreign. So naturally, why would I feel like I fit in here? Like,
That's true. Yeah. I think it's mad, isn't it, that a lot of people feel like they should rush and just do everything straight away. And I think actually the fact that, I mean, you can say that, you know, you took some time.
Yeah, I mean, saying that I took some time makes it sound like it was by choice. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. It's only by chance that, like, I have no A-levels. So it's only by chance that I dropped out of college twice. I ended up doing an art foundation because I broke my ankle really badly and couldn't really work properly. The only good thing about not having any A-levels is the fact that at the age of 20, 21, my art foundation ended up being free because I didn't have any like level 3 qualifications. It's a beautiful turn of events. I didn't think I was going to go to uni, and then everyone was applying for uni and I was just like, well, sod it. Why? Let's just give it a go. We'll see what happens. And then 6 years later, we're here and it's been peaks and troughs and it's been a bit mental, but I wouldn't change it for the world. I think I have this kind of this odd sense of guilt of the fact that it took me so long to get to this position.
But it shouldn't, because...
No, it's such a strange feeling to have.
Hmm.
But then I think that kind of imposter syndrome and things like that, I think it feeds into kind of mental health and things like that. I recognise with a lot of, not necessarily my peers and around my age, but kind of... creeping up around the kind of like 25 mark, I can see a lot of like lack of self-worth and things like that that feed into all of these things as well, and I've recognized that in myself, and I think I'm only just starting to come out the other side at 28. And again, I think it comes from grading systems and education and the way that it feeds into the fact that you constantly need these forms of quite possibly unhealthy validation. But it's tricky.
It is tricky. And I guess when you come out of that system, it's sort of like, you've got none of that.
So who's gonna blow smoke up my ass now?
Yeah.
Like, who's gonna hold my hand while I go and ask the nice man for a job? It was really interesting. Having studied with such different people, especially on the masters, watching the confidence grow within certain people, like Georgia, who is utterly one of my favourite humans that I think I've ever met. She did, she studied graphic design. And you could see that when she started, she didn't have the confidence at all. She was not overly confident in her work or anything like this. And which is ridiculous, because actually I think other than Ian, she had or our tutor, she had some of the most experience, and was utterly amazing at what she did. But being able to see her grow in that year as well. I mean, I say in that year, we got to spend half the year together, and then obviously March hit and we were all working remotely, and some people ended up moving home, some people stayed in Falmouth. It was all over the shop. And that in itself was utterly bizarre. And finishing, that's... Sometimes I question whether I feel like it was a massive anticlimax, and whether I came out of finishing this master's feeling like nothing had really happened, because we didn't finish together.
No, yeah.
But then actually, I think that's just what happens with a creative degree.
That's true.
I think that's just what happens. You never really come out actually feeling like a fully formed person, which is what you're meant to do, especially when you're paying like $9,000 a year. Or when you get funding for a master's, it goes straight into your bank account and you have to pay the fees.
Yeah, which I didn't realise until I spoke to my friend the other day.
It's terrifying.
So you get the whole bulk, and then you have to give it to the university? Is that how it
they
works?
They do it in three sections. So it's kind of like you do with your student loan over a year. But when you get that lump, you then have to pay your fees over. It just feels too grown up, but also you're a student, so you shouldn't feel grown up. That's one of the best things about being a student, is being able to exist in that kind of like limbo of borderline adulthood, but not quite. If I could go back to that, and part of me feels like I didn't embrace it enough. I definitely did in my first year, but I think, yeah, when it came to second year, I worked too much. And then third year, I had to defer in third year. And so I basically did my degree over 4 years, which is amazing. So indulgent. You basically get to have an extra year to think about what you're going to do.
I really wish
you And then come back years. And go, right, I'm doing this. Should have gone to Scotland.
Yeah.
It's 4 years in Scotland.
I mean, let's go back to, so you graduated in the pandemic.
Yeah.
How did you feel
when
you clicked that button?
It literally was so underwhelming. It's that kind of because with our first hand in, we had the mania where you spend all night in the library with a group of three of you, and you're drinking energy drinks / loads of wine, and you're going a bit mental, and you're cutting it right to the bone. And then when the pandemic happened, we were halfway through our second module. And so everyone was kind of okay. We were getting there, because we already had the projects that we were working on. So that was when we did compete. So we did DNAD. I obviously loaded myself up and did three competitions. So I did two DNA debriefs and a penguin book cover.
Wow.
Because, why not? Why wouldn't you do that? Never do that. That's my advice. Never do that. And one of the DNAD ones was a collaboration, but the girl that I was working with was back in Milan as well. So,
wow.
That was mental in itself. We didn't win any pencils. Although one girl on my course did win a pencil, actually, and was listed as one of the ones to watch, which was really cool. But after we handed that in, so you already had the kind of anticlimax of that one. And then just getting started in that. And it's the final project as well, so it's a big one.
Mm.
Trying to actually figure out what you're going to do when you're not sat in that studio environment and you're bouncing ideas off of each other. And yeah. It's like, and it is the most, it's, I say it in the best way possible, but it is one of the most indulgent and most glorious environments to be in, whether it's a professional studio, whether it's a uni studio or anything like that, whether it's graphics, whether it's arts, whether it's illustration. Being in that environment is so important for actually creating, let alone even if you just sat there having a conversation, it's so important. And it's just, and it's utterly glorious. So we all really struggled with getting on with what we were doing. Yeah, it was when, the people that were still in Falmouth, after we all handed in, they all got to meet on the beach, and someone set up their laptop with a hotspot, and so you had me and like four other people on Zoom, just with everyone else sat like drinking champagne, well, drinking like sparkling wine on the beach, just going, include us. And then it's just this kind of like, okay. And I've got a photograph that I took of the screen, because it was just like, all right then, bye everybody.
Oh, no. Yeah.
And I think you build up such camaraderie from being in that shared space that it doesn't feel like I've graduated, but it, like, part of me feels like I never really did a master's, because it was such an anticlimax when I finished.
Well, yeah, to be honest, I still think I'm in second year, because I never really finished it.
It's just like, yeah, exactly. It's that kind of like, how are you meant to, but then also, how are they meant to change that for us?
No. Yeah, they can't, can they?
I mean, I'm really hoping that we actually get to do graduation.
I hope so.
So our graduation is meant to be in August, I think, so fingers crossed.
So what was it like? So you'd graduated, you'd handed everything in. How did you go about sort of looking for placements? And
oh, I went down the full... No one was interested in my portfolio, and I was actually starting to really struggle with it, and it was really quite depressing. And I know it's because I'm not very good at selling myself. I'm not very good at writing about myself. So I know that was a big part to do it. So actually, even just enticing someone to look at my portfolio probably wasn't really happening. But so I went down the full like nepotism route, and my mum was doing some work for her boss with one of the studios in town.
Okay.
And she got them to look at my portfolio, and so I did a month there, and it was really lovely working with them. They're such an amazing team, and they do some really lovely stuff, but with the aspect of how I look at design, it felt a little bit more kind of like making things look pretty for the sake of it, rather than actually being able to get my teeth into anything. And then I bumped into Warren, my boss, on a dog walk through town, basically.
That's great.
Doug and Coco met. And this was when Doug was still a tiny little thing. He's still a tiny little thing, but relatively he's enormous now. and oddly, I had been talking about him to somebody that morning.
Okay.
And so I was like, interesting, I was talking about you this morning. And we kind of natted a little bit, and I said that I really enjoy branding, but I really need to be able to, like, I really love that kind of research side of things, which is what I really enjoy, like, really enjoy about strategy, and what I've been able to carry over from my fine art side. So my kind of semi, like the slither of the academic that's still within me is now actually being fulfilled through that side of things. And so it's been, so I did a kind of month and a half or so working as an intern for him. And it was pretty much just me and him trotting along, starting to build up everything and kind of get things working and get things running smoothly. And now we've ended up with four interns that we kind of, who are absolutely amazing. We've got, so three design and one digital marketing. And so it's been, it's just amazing being able to work in a team again. And having that kind of, I mean, I'm going to sound like a ridiculous person, go that youthful energy, because I know that I'm still, like, I'm not even 30, so I should count as one of those people, but sometimes I really don't feel it. But yeah, and so I, like I said before, with this imposter syndrome, I know that I'm one of very few people from my master's who are actually working within the industry, which makes me really sad, because they're all so talented. And it makes me, and I think having that feeds into the imposter syndrome as well, because it's that kind of like, I know I earn this. I know that I deserve to be in this position, and I work hard for it. But also part of me goes, but I kind of ended up blagging my way into it, so I don't really, and I don't really know how that happened. But my God, am I thankful.
Yeah.
Because I think that's one side of design that I struggle with, is so much of it is based on aesthetics.
Yeah.
When actually it needs to be driven by purpose and being a solution rather than just being something that looks pretty.
That's so true.
It's like putting a plaster on a gaping wound. Like it actually needs to be a full bandage. Yeah. And so being able to work in a studio and it feeds into this, the element of social design as well. So we work within personality-led design.
Okay.
So it's very much working with the client, making sure that they are ingrained in everything that we're creating for their brand. So there's a lot of co-creation, a lot of discussion with them. I get to sit down with them and ask really weird questions that make them kind of go, what, that doesn't really have any relevance. But then down the line, they can see that there's a reason for it. So we have the public sector side of things that we do. So before I started, they've done work for Invest in Shropshire, Right Home, Right Place, a lot of work with Shropshire Council. But all of these things, I feel really proud to be a part of that studio, because all of these things feed into that aspect of social design and not doing harm, because so much of whether it's intentional or not, like a lot of bad design is made with good intention.
Yeah.
It's just ill-informed.
No, that's very and, true.
And so being able to work with the client in the way that we do means that we get some really interesting results.
Yeah.
And it means that we don't, like, Warren's very much of the fact that he's aware of trends but doesn't necessarily follow them. Mm. And you can see that in all of the brands that he's worked with, really, because each one is totally different. So he works with different illustrators for different brands. Like within the private sector of things, he's been working with a tea company that are based out in Burma, I'm going to say. Myanmar, I think it's called.
Okay.
Called Lost Tea, the Lost Tea Company. And they actually work with, it's all fair trade, and they work with the farmers that are there, they've actually upped the sales within that area rather than hotels actually like importing Western teas, like Twinings and stuff like that, for because they think that that's what the tourists want. Instead, he's been able to push this all of the like naturally grown green teas, and they're looking at launching a few new products that we're working on at the moment. So it's getting to do all of these things that really like working for with good people is so rewarding. And I think that that gets lost when you end up working for a big agency and you end up working with big clients.
Yeah, that's so true.
Not that I'm saying that from experience, I'm saying that from observations.
Yeah, just from an outside. But yeah, I mean, it, yeah, it looks to be, that looks to be the case. And it's, I think it's as well, like at uni, they push you to like talk to these big agencies and meet these big, and it's like, what about the little ones? What about all these little ones that are doing great things?
Absolutely. Like Warren still pushes to do pro bono work and things like that when there's the right client. We did work, I say we, I wasn't there at that point, but they did the brand refresh for The Hive, which a charity in the centre of Shrewsbury. And they work with like young adults and children. But it's quite a complicated one because they work within the arts, but they also have a venue where they put on like performances, whether it's music, theatre. They also have a little exhibition space in there as well. So like they had to do this big kind of like mashup of figuring out, and obviously everybody works there part-time, some like they've got a lot of volunteers and things like that as well. Like it's a big thing, and I know the Warren offered to do the work pro bono, and working for someone who wants to do that kind of thing, I mean, it, like I'm a huge advocate when it comes to female health and wanting to push and break through all of those taboos. And it's really refreshing working for someone who wants those voices to come out and wants those voices to be a part of the studio. To like, he's encouraging all of the new starters to talk about stuff and have fun and actually grow their voices and develop these kind of professional points of view and presences as well online. Because he knows that this feeds into the idea of having this collaborative studio, and being able to have that out there means that actually, I mean, it ends up working in his favor, really, because when you can see the people that you're working with, you're more likely to go, yeah, they're the ones that I want to work with. Like, they do good shit.
Amazing. It's so nice to hear you talk about it as well, because you can tell that like you love it.
Oh, it's great. I mean, I will always make jokes about the fact that I don't necessarily know what I do. Obviously, I know what I do, but it's the imposter coming out in me, just going, this is such a strange kind of feeling. It's like, and I think a lot of it comes from the fact that there are people with so much more experience than me that I studied with, that I almost feel like they're more worthy to be in my position. That's not true.
No, not like, at all.
But yeah, to work for someone who gets excited for you to have a voice and that encourages you to actually use Instagram and LinkedIn, I think for me it's really interesting because I never... Like, I need to rewrite my LinkedIn bio. It's the wankiest thing I think I've ever written in my entire life. I'm better off just not having it there, I think. But it really, it's been really beneficial for me because it's really made me think about how to put myself out there. So, because technically I'm still working as a freelancer for Warren. So it is that kind of like, as it goes on, it's that kind of what's going to be the next step.
Yeah.
And making sure that I benefit the business as much as the benefit, as the business benefits me.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Which I've never been I've never really thought about that before.
No, yeah.
But I think the fact that we're in such a strange kind of social and professional climates at the moment. I mean, being able to work from remotely is the only reason that I've been able to make the move to London and carry on working. But I think the biggest challenge that I've found is trying to make sure, and I was really lucky with the first internship that I did that first month.
Yeah.
I was in the studio. I was in the studio with everyone, so I got to have that kind of studio culture experience that I think maybe a tiny little like thimble full of interns have been able to get this year.
Yeah.
And so it's definitely made me want to make sure that there is that almost studio culture being built up, even though we're working online. Yeah. And we're working in different parts of the country from each other,
which is just imagine
it's been a challenge.
Yeah.
Like today, I did a portrait of one of the interns with googly eyes and started a game of consequences, you know, the way you have to draw different parts of the body.
Oh, wow.
Yep, so he gave himself a giraffe neck, and then somebody else has given him some pretty hench shoulders.
Amazing.
Yeah, so we'll see how that goes as well. But it's trying to build up those little things, like... because normally you'd be able to get like little pockets of stuff, and like you'd be able to just kind of like run off and make a cup of tea with someone and have a little gossip, and you just can't do that anymore.
It does feel like it's all work, and
I feel guilty if I take a lunch break at the moment.
It shouldn't be like
which
that.
Which is just... yeah, absolutely. It's like, I honestly feel like I need to constantly be working because I'm at home, and so I don't feel like I'm working. So I need to constantly be doing something to prove that I'm working, when actually I just want to take 10 minutes and eat some toast. Like, having the dog's been really good for that, because it means that for an hour in the afternoon I take him out and we have that little routine now that we're building. But if I didn't have him, then I'd probably be like cowered in a corner from like morning, noon and night, just going, no, I've got one more thing to do.
It's showing people that you're like there as well. You're like, yes, I'm here, I'm doing work, I'm...
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing that we've I've kind of pushed with all of the newbies is you don't actually have to be listed as online 24/7 for us to know that you're there. As long as you have a kind of like 20-minute window that you're able to reply within.
That's so good.
Then we know that you're there. Because otherwise, again, you just have this pressure. I mean, it feels quite... It was Anthony Burrell was the last person that you had on here,
yes.
Right? Cool. I feel quite privileged being on the same list as him. I feel very cool now.
No, it's amazing. I'm so glad you wanted to be involved, honestly. Because I think it's so hard to get your voice out there and have an opinion.
Oh, absolutely.
And then the fact that everyone in that agency is getting pushed, and it's just great.
Yeah, it's so refreshing.
Thank you so much for being involved.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been so lovely having a natter.